Session number 21554, Reel 4.
What was the situation of morale on board ship coming home?
Oh, it wasn't the greatest. No, it wasn't. Because of the condition of the ship, I think it had a lot to do with it too. And the long time that we were on, was this what happened? Long time we were aboard the ship. When we went over, 14 days from Fremantle to Port Chufik, including the day and a half in Trigamalee, that was 12 and a half days. From Port Chufik back to Fremantle took us 6 weeks. So you can imagine that the troops would be pretty bored and not too happy. It was a big convoy, and I don't know what it was, a battleship in the middle of it, because we were all protecting the battleship in a lot of ways. It wasn't so much protecting us. I suppose, in a way, it might have been more valuable. We must have finished up shortly down here in South Africa somewhere, because I think we spent nearly a week heading east before we hit Fremantle. And by God, it was rough, too. Yeah. But that was how long the trip took, 6 weeks from start to finish. So you can understand that the blokes, it was pretty trying. When you got such a massive load on such poor accommodation, you know.
What about you hearing of the fall of Singapore, for instance? That was to happen in February 15th.
Yeah, well, we'd have been at sea at the time.
And you didn't.
Well, they used to get a report. You know, every day there'd be some sort of a report read out that they had got, but. I can't say I do remember that specifically about that, John. Only that we knew that things were getting much closer to home all the time, and that's why we realised we should be home.
Tell us then of what it was like to arrive home.
Well, when we arrived home, strange enough, the other two battalions were with us, the 2nd 14th and 7th 37th. We were left out just outside Gage Roads for a day. They were brought in and we weren't. And of course, in consequence, and then when we did get ashore, everyone was given 24 hours leave. And a big percentage, the biggest percentage, I suppose, of our battalion came from the country. What they expected them to do, I don't know. Well, unfortunately, and I know it doesn't sound good, but unfortunately, most of them took their own leave because their homes were in Kalgoorlie. I know the war was still on, and they would be the first blokes to get back into it. But to give them 24 hours leave when we could have come in the day before was, I think, a very poor effort on the behalf of the army, very poor in time. And of course, when we did arrive home, it was a bit of a euphoria about it because people realised that you'd been to a war and you'd come home again.
Was there sort of a welcoming on the wharf?
No, not on the wharf because there was, you couldn't get on board on the wharf at the time, no.
What did the welcoming then sort of
entail? Well, you just, when you do, you went off on leave and you sort of went into the town itself, so it wasn't like welcome of marching up the street or something like that. You just sort of met people, you know, not in any numbers or anything, John. You just went out, like you'd go if you'd been going out of Northern Camp on your leave, just went out on leave.
Did you manage to get back home and see your parents?
Well, my home was in Fremantle, really. My home was in Fremantle. Well, I had enlisted in Bunbury, my home was in Fremantle. And actually, my father worked on the waterfront at the time, and so I met up with him as soon as I... on the grapevine, they know that you're there. It's marvellous. It's like a bit when my brother met me in Palestine. I hadn't written to... Well, you weren't allowed to write and say what you're doing, and yet... We arrived, say, on a Wednesday and Thursday, and the first Sunday Sunday was your day, your own, almost, when you were in the army, he arrived at the camp where I was, you know. The grapevine's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
What did it feel like coming back from the Middle East, having been away for a while and having experienced all you'd experienced? What was it like seeing the western coast of Western Australia coming up over the horizon?
Although the Japs were in there, I know you mean that way, but one of the things that struck me most was that although you knew the Japs were in the war, it did surprise you a bit to go home and find that they had a slit trench dug down the backyard, you know. Surely it's not that bad, although it was I mean, we're still a long way away from the war in Fremantle. We're still a couple of thousand miles south of even Wyndham, so you're still quite a bit. But it did surprise me a bit to find, and another thing it did, I was surprised to see, was the straight away that they had anti-aircraft guns in the railway yards. That didn't take them long to set things up, you know. But I think it's the slit trenches were the things that amazed me, surprised me most of all, especially in my own parents' backyard. I thought, you know, didn't feel it. I don't mean you didn't feel that Australia was in danger. You didn't feel that Fremantle was in danger.
What were some of the things that, that people were talking about, the Japanese?
Oh, only it was good to see that our blokes had come home, you know, they were, how pleased they were that at last that we had. Well, actually, we weren't that far. From the time that we left the Middle East, we weren't that far behind when the Japs had come into the war. When we left there in January and only came into it in December. So we weren't that far from when it when they had declared war.
As I understand, you had arrived back in Australia in March of 42.
Yeah.
By that time, Darwin had started to be bombed. It had been bombed on the 19th of February of that year. What were the feelings then Australia has been attacked?
No, yeah, well, yeah, but I think you still felt that even though it had been attacked, it was, I don't mean that there wasn't any danger, but it still felt that it was a long way away, you know, being so far away. That's one of the things, I suppose, is good or bad, I don't know, of such a big country, you know, that although the country can have been attacked, that it was attacked from the air, not, you know, not from, by land, from the sea. But,
they still had to get here, almost.
Yeah, still feel. Yeah, I do think that. Did think that, please.
Were you able to talk about your experiences with your parents?
Oh, yes. Not a great amount, though. No, not a great amount. They didn't, well. I think even right throughout, it wasn't really speaking. It was only in recent years that I think anyone has really spoken a great amount about it, which I think was wrong. I don't mean at that stage when we first came back from the Middle East you could talk to your parents, but it's something I think that most people have to get old to realise that we were all wrong to have kept it to ourselves for so long. Because even if you only stop one person from getting killed or one day of warfare, to have let people know the horrors of war, because there's nothing nice about it. But I think that practically all people... It was a bit like a club or a lodge or something like that that you only spoke about amongst your own people. And yet when you did meet your own mates and you had a few beers, you would talk about it, but you wouldn't talk about it to outsiders. I don't think you felt directly that they weren't entitled to know, but maybe you just felt, like I say, in a lodge, they didn't know what it was about, and you didn't talk to them about it.
Did you feel as though they weren't really wanting to talk about it with you? They were avoiding the issues, possibly?
No, I don't. Oh, no, I don't think so. No, I don't think so, John. No, I hadn't thought of it along those lines at all. You just didn't discuss it a great amount. Only what a bastard Hitler was, and this sort of thing, to have done the things he didn't, to start it all this, and to have cost so many lives.
What did it feel like having left comrades behind who'd been killed?
No, well, I can't say that I felt that I thought a great amount of that, because as I said, when I saw chaps get killed alongside me, maybe if my own brother had happened to him, I might have had a different feeling about it. But even the other chaps were your mates. I think it was just that because of the training you'd had, and perhaps you expect this to happen, it's got to happen to someone, but. You have to get on with your life, a bit like in civilian life. I mean, you hear of some people, I know it's a terrible loss when you lose someone in the family, and you've got it in the back of your mind probably, but life goes on, doesn't it?
What degree was there this sort of blocking out going on, do you think?
Not intentionally, no. Not intentionally, just something that happens. Wouldn't be that you tried to shut it out.
What precautions were being, I mean, you mentioned the slit trenches, what precautions were being taken in Perth?
Oh, the blackouts, the little lights, you know, just little slits for the motor cars, And of course, I remember the gas producers on the backs of the cars. On the there used to be in Fremantle there was a thing called a parlour coach. It's like a cross between a taxi and a bus, and they used to stoke up the gas producer on the back of it, and they went along pretty reasonably well. But they were sort of things that stuck in your mind because it's, you know, 50, nearly 60 years ago now. They were things that stuck in your mind that that there was a war. Well, apart from the fact that you knew there was one on, but these were things that, and rationing, of course, food rationing, clothing, food. There are some of the things that do stick in your mind, and the likes of on some of the ovals around the place, mostly anti-aircraft things, anti-aircraft batteries set up on, for instance, down here in East Fremantle Oval, you know, there was an anti-aircraft battery set up there, things that like that. Then you realise that the war was coming to Australia, which is something, of course, I wasn't there for the First War, naturally, but something would never have been seen in this country before.
What sort of propaganda were you experiencing regarding, you know, the possibility of the coming of the Japanese?
No, I can't say. I heard as I understand,
propaganda. As I understand, there was this talk of, you know, the Brisbane line and evacuating south.
Well, yeah, I didn't hear about that at the time. No, I didn't realise that Brisbane line had been such until after the war. I think there'd been a lot of hostility if there had been, wouldn't there? But no, I didn't know at the time for certain. Even though we did our training in the eastern states within that line. Oh, yeah, well, just north of where, north. Well, early in the piece, we were in Adelaide for a while, and then in the Glenners, New South Wales, finished up in Maroochydore in Queensland, but that was about 60 miles north of Brisbane, of course. No, I hadn't heard about the Brisbane line at all.
As you understood it, as you learnt about it, what do you think it meant? How do you explain the idea behind it?
Well, coming from Western Australia, you would have thought very poorly of it. Meant that we were going to be left out in the limb, which is a bit like what Churchill did say about Australia, didn't he? Say, well, they were dispensable, the Australians, that we could always come back and get them later, providing that Britain won the war. Well, the Allies won the war, but I believe that was what was said by him, that they would come back. And I suppose that's how they felt about it in regard to Western Australia. But had we known about the time, we'd been wouldn't have felt good. We'd probably wanted to be back home defending your own state.
What was to happen after you had your 24 hours leave?
Well, I'm afraid I, like a lot of others, didn't go back after 24 hours. And finished up going back a couple of days after that. And, I think half the battalion, more than half the battalion, didn't go back at the time, didn't go back for a couple of days. And then we went to Adelaide on a big Yankee ship, the Monterey, which had come from up north and had mostly civilian refugees, what do you call them? They'd come out of Singapore and places like that. And some Australian troops who had been evacuated, or evacuees, I should have called them, and some Australian troops. And we went from here to Adelaide on it. That was a great trip.
What was the result of you having gone AWOL?
Got fined £5, which was a lot of money. And then sent back to your battalion in Adelaide just the same.
Was it worth it, do you think?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I'm sure it was. I'm sure those couple of days wouldn't have made that much difference to the army or to the war effort at that stage. When you consider that was March, and we didn't go up to New Guinea until August. So I think they all felt, and I think everyone felt that had they been given a reasonable amount of leave at the time, the morale would have been a lot better. It wasn't very good for morale to have been back in your own home port, not allowed to go, not permitted to go and see your own people. Especially when you consider it wasn't August that we went up to New Guinea. But, so we went to Adelaide from there. We were in Springbank in Adelaide, just out of, was it, Colonel Light Gardens. The difference in the way troops are treated, we went over on this Yankee Monterey, and the first meal on board was roast pork. Next night, it was roast chicken, and you didn't get stuck in a dixie like we had our food. You had a stainless steel tray, and they put the meat there and the vegetables there and the sweets there, and everything was separated. And after the meal, when the American officers came, some of our blokes said, you know, what do you guys think about this chow or something like that? You know, it's great. He said, our guys are still complaining. I think there was 500 of us on board, and they served 500 extra serves because they were back for a second helping. But strawberry jam, not apple jelly or something like that. But the difference in the way that, whether it was good or not, they reckon that our blokes were used to hard food, hard tucker, and had a harder living than the Americans, maybe it paid off better when the time came that you had to live that way.
What was the attitude towards the Americans?
Not great. Well, I don't suppose you should blame our female population. It's a terrible thing to say, but of course we were away at the time, and as you know, the Australians were very poorly paid and the Americans were so well paid and they could afford to, and without knocking the girls, if you've got a bit more money to splash around, I suppose teenagers, it attracts people a bit more, doesn't it? And it goes with the Americans all dressed up in the beautiful uniforms as against our pretty rough type of uniform. A bit of glamour. But,
MacArthur was in Australia at that point. How was he seen?
He got out of the Philippines. I don't think anyone was too happy about that. I shall return. Of course, our feelings personally towards MacArthur were more afterwards, after New Guinea campaign, not before it. I think with a lot of those things, even though you mightn't be that happy, you take a lot of it. Well, this is the way it's run, you know, and they should know what they're doing. I don't think that you give a great amount of thought, as I mentioned before. As a matter of fact, with that, outside your own battalion, I don't think you give a great amount of thought to, as long as your blokes are doing the right thing, which they always did do, because we had such great officers amongst our battalion, and that was the main thing, that we respected them no end, and I think that was a big help. Unfortunately, the other bloke, the Australian commander, was never regarded, blame me, I don't think he ever was regarded very highly by the troops, never at any stage.
Why do you think that was?
I think he had a bad reputation. Civil life, he had a bad reputation. And from what we'd heard him, what we were told, he had a bad reputation. I don't think that helped his people have respect. I don't think anyone ever had a great amount of respect for him. Of course, we didn't really know about MacArthur, except that he'd left the Philippines. And yet we had a bloke come out of Singapore, Gordon Bennett. And when he did that, he got abused for it. When MacArthur did it, they reckon he was a great bloke. The same thing, wasn't it? Strange, isn't it?
Did you know then what was going on? You were going to do training to be sent up to New Guinea eventually?
Well, didn't know it was New Guinea. Knew that we'd have to, because of what had happened in Java, we knew we'd have to go up and meet the Japs somewhere sometime.
How were they seen by the average troop?
Well, of course, the stories you'd heard about the poor old Jap with his thick glasses and short stature, of course, which was so false, you know, the impression that had been given of them wasn't so great. And, of course, stories had already filtered back of the way they treated people, which was the men all the more determined when they did go up there that they had something really to fight against, as against perhaps having fought against the Vichy French. I mean, a bullet's a bullet, I know that, and it doesn't matter who fires it, but the ill feeling towards the Japanese before you ever went there was, you didn't have the same respect. I often think of the respect that in the First World War that the Australians and Turks had for each other, but no such thing when you came up against the Japanese. There was so much hatred engendered in every way towards them.
What was the training and what did it involve?
Well, our training in Adelaide wasn't a great amount. It was, I think they were sorting all things out, seeing everyone come back from Australia. It was only route marching and drill. And in Gleninus was another bit the same way. It wasn't really until we got up into Maroochydore, where you're in more tropical country, and you did, everyone, you always do a lot of route marching, that's to get you into good nick, but we used to have river crossings and stunts in the, because a lot of, it wasn't exactly jungle warfare, but it's not that far from it. It's very thick country up, well, it was up around Maroochydore, now it's like the Gold Coast. They call it the Sunshine Coast, but we used to have lots of river crossings and where you'd wrap your gear up in your ground sheet and make it, it was floatable then, you know, and swim across the rivers and pushing that in front of you. Of course, some of the blokes always circumvented that and found a boat somewhere and rowed across the river, but still, and I got into strife for doing it, but still, that's Australian initiative, isn't it? Yeah. And if you found a boat and you're in warfare and you could get across quickly and swim across, why not? Yeah. Of course, and in Maroochydore, we, when we first went there, unfortunately, there'd been young militia battalions there before us, and they hadn't done the right thing, and when we first went to Maroochydore, the feeling wasn't too great towards us because of what had happened before. But by the time we left there, we had got on exceptionally well with the people of Queensland, so much so that they'd built a reading and writing room for us. In fact, I wouldn't say about half a dozen of our blokes married Maroochydore girls. One of the ladies is still up that way now. She lost her husband since we were down here just recently. But we got an exception with them. The only thing they had against us wasn't worth no saying that we put all their beaches under barbed wire, doubled down at barbed wire, which they weren't too happy about. But we had been told then that if the Japs could land, it was the only place they could come in through the Barrier Reef or something was in that area. So we put all their lovely beaches under barbed wire. That didn't go over too well with them. But that was done early after we went up there. But by the time we left there, they had a lot of respect for us, and we for them. In fact, they used to ask us at weekends, because they didn't have manpower to pick their crops like pineapples and strawberries and that, if we'd like to go up and help them. And blokes did. Help yourself, but go up just to do the right thing by them. But the training we had mostly, it was a lot of it was for river crossings and a lot of route marching. Wasn't quite jungle training, but it was, I suppose, the closest we could get to it.
What was the feeling in Queensland at the time regarding the possible invasion?
Oh, just a matter of when are we going to go, you know? How much more do we have to do this before? Because with all of our chaps then, well, pretty well all, had been in action. And they felt that they didn't need that much more. I mean, I know jungle training is different, but having been in action is a big thing too. The experience of knowing what to expect, even if it's a different type of fighting, that I think most of them felt that, you know, how come we aren't going up there soon? Of course, when you get there, I suppose this, well, it nearly wasn't soon enough, wasn't it? It was only a matter of a couple of days, and it wouldn't have been soon enough. It was cut very fine. Unfortunately, it shouldn't have been.
Do you think that there was a certain degree of overconfidence at this stage?
By us or by the powers that be? Oh, no, I don't think so. Because we had gone so badly in Singapore and Java and Malaya and those places, I don't think there was any overconfidence in them.
To what degree had, as I understand, there was this sort of, let's get into it.
Oh, yeah.
Get them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's it. The sooner we do, the better, because they're getting closer to Australia. We didn't know, even know then, that it was just going to be New Guinea necessarily. We didn't know just how far they had got. Well, while we were first in Maroochydore, of course, they hadn't landed in New Guinea then.
Tell us about the departure and what you knew about going.
Well, our departure, we went by train up to Brisbane. And did we train or truck? I forget now, it don't matter. And when we went aboard the ship, of course, we went aboard Liberty ships. They were the ones that were built in America. I'm sure they were built on their side, not built upright like a ship. I think it was, the Kaiser shipyards had built these things. They were just cargo ships. And I think they used to reckon that they were built so quickly and so cheaply that if they did one trip, they just sort of paid themselves. So we had this trip from Brisbane up to Moresby, up the inside of the Barrier Reef, and I remember that very well because on this James Wilson, being a cargo ship, the only ablution facilities it had were two great long horse trough things, one on either side of the ship, with a hose or water coming in one end of it and running out the other. And unfortunately, it was only a day or so out that there was quite a bit of diarrhoea set in. And this is true, that although you were washing at one end of one trough, the blokes at the far end of it were defecating in it because that was had to be used as that at that stage. So it was, I think if today's conditions, which are demanded by people, in those days, and I don't mean you were happy about it, but you didn't really complain about it. I mean, that was all part of your training, and you were going to war. And I remember saying to one of the Yanks one time, "You haven't got many lifeboats on here." And he said, "Well, Guy," he said, "if this thing gets hit," he said, "lifeboats won't be much good to you, bastard," or something like that. Because we knew, and then we had found out that we were sleeping in the tween decks, and they wanted to do something down below, and we had to shift our gear, and they took up the slabs from the tween decks, and our trucks loaded with ammunition and all that sort of stuff were on top of all this explosive and the ammunition that was underneath them in the ship. So it was a pretty explosive sort of trip that we had up on the James Wilson up to Moresby. And when we got to Moresby, I think we heard that up till then been bombed every day for quite some time. The day we arrived, it didn't get bombed. So that was, I know that someone was looking after us on that day when the ship arrived up there.
Well, the Battle of Coral Sea had also occurred. Did you know about that?
Not particularly, I think. No, not from memory. No. A lot of these things you've heard about after and read about, but not specifically.
Yeah. So there was this sort of being kept in the dark sort of thing the whole
time? Oh, yeah, because you didn't... Well, we didn't even know where we were going until we got to Moresby, really. You didn't know where you were going to be landed off. I don't remember us being told just where we were going to, for sure. One of the things I remember first, when I first... on the ship in Moresby, seeing a lot of these places, out of Moresby, places had been bombed, but their outside toilets were still standing up. I know it's a minor thing, but just how little things stick in your mind, I can still see those parts of Moresby like that. And then, of course, we land in Moresby, and I don't think you couldn't get off the ship quick enough, knowing how Moresby had been bombed previously. And we drove around in the trucks, we landed in the trucks, around Moresby town itself and out to a place called Aitiki. Of course, the roads were pretty rough then, and we had to finish up pushing our own truck up the hill because they were getting bogged on the way out there.
What were your initial impressions of New Guinea?
Damp and wet, because it used to rain every day at 4 o'clock. So you're nearly always wet or steamy to a certain extent. And when we got to this Aitiki, we had to make our own shelters. You know, put up a bit of a framework, because we're only there, I forget just how many days, where we got things sorted out, and put up this framework with these big banana leaves and that for shelter over the top of you.
What were people telling you about the Japanese at that point?
Well, we, not just individually, we were paraded. I can well remember a parade we had at this little place called Aitiki. Well, it was a place, it's only a camp, a staging camp, that we were paraded and told that approximately 1,200 Japanese had landed on the north coast. And I remember thinking to myself at the time, well, that's no big... Just to myself, and others probably thought the same, that's no big deal, really, because there's the... Well, I suppose we... I know you say a battalion could be up to 1,000, but probably it's about... because of the transport can't go up and certain things can't be done, but... If there's 600 of us and 600 of the second 14th, because the second 27th weren't with us then, they were came up a few days later, that's 1,200, and there's what's left of what there might be of the two militia battalions. Of course, there wasn't many left of them, the 39th and the 53rd. I thought, well, at least, you know, yeah, six or one half dozen out. And I think people felt, oh, well, that's no big deal.
Had you heard about Kokoda, for instance, the Kokoda track and anything like that at that point?
Only just at that stage we were told, you know, that going was going to be tough, that we could only carry a certain amount and that carriers would have to carry other suppliers for us, and that suppliers would be landed for us up in the ranges at the Myola, the place called Myola. But what I was getting at before was that I felt, well, at least we've got even numbers, so it's, but we didn't know that the 1,200 was more like 12,000. Unfortunately, the, what do you call them, the eye section, not our eye section, but the eye section overall hadn't done a very good job, because I thought it was 1,200 instead of about, well, it was 10,000 or some figure like that. I thought it was 10 or 12,000 instead of hundreds.